Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through Delta Airlines and Delta Connection partner ExpressJet, with direct flights from Tallahassee to Atlanta connecting to over 315 destinations worldwide. Fares and information available online at delta.com. And from HR Florida State Council, representing 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for workplace best practices for the media, lawmakers, and Florida's human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
We begin with the latest on the so-called warning shot bill, which aims to fix the unintended consequences of Florida's 1020 life law.
I think it's been a good law for the state of Florida, but as all good laws are, they sometimes need to be tweaked as they move along.
Also tonight, a scathing Miami Herald report lays the deaths of hundreds of children squarely at the feet of the Florida Department of Children and Families.
We are sending people into these complex environments that don't have the training, the skills, or the knowledge.
We'll also talk about personhood versus Planned Parenthood, a new company to provide public school testing materials for Florida, and why lawmakers will bring their usual proceedings to a halt for part of tomorrow. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the start of week three of the 2014 Florida lawmaking session. Welcome to Capitol Report. The news has been so dominated by Florida's Stand Your Ground law in recent years that it's easy to overlook some other gun-related bills that state lawmakers are now considering. For instance, a bill allowing someone to threaten the use of force in situations where they themselves feel threatened is expected to hit the Senate floor this week. And as Sasha Cordner reports, the so-called warning shot bill that was modified at each of its committee stops may go through yet more changes on the floor.
Former Republican lawmaker Victor Crist's 1020 life law was intended to crack down on criminals. That's according to Greg Newburn, the Florida director for the group Families Against Mandatory Minimums, who says Crist never meant it to apply in self-defense cases, yet it has multiple times. Newburn adds the short-term result is a series of what he calls shockingly unjust cases.
Ronald Thompson, who got 20 years for discharging his firearm in what he considered to be a self-defense situation. 20 years for Marla Swearingen, who fired into the air to stop a fight. 20 years for Eric Wayant, who was surrounded by a group of men outside of a bar and fired his gun into the air after they threatened to beat him. 20 years for Lee Wallard for firing into the wall of his own home. Et cetera, et cetera. Just these four cases is 80 years of prison time and almost $2 million of tax money to incarcerate four people who have never hurt anyone in their lives.
And Newburn says the long-term result is people who find themselves in a life-threatening situation wondering whether they should threaten to use force or decide not to because they fear they'll face a minimum mandatory sentence. So Baker Republican Senator Greg Evers' bill seeks to clarify the existing self-defense law by removing that fear of prosecution and allowing the display of a weapon or firing a warning shot. It also allows for an exonerated person to petition to have their record expunged. At the bill's previous stop, Evers removed aggravated assault from Florida's 10-20 life law. That was what Marissa Alexander was initially charged with when she got a lengthy prison term for firing a warning shot during an alleged domestic dispute with her husband in Jacksonville. And at its last stop, Senate Rules Chairman John Thrasher replaced that change with an amendment Evers agrees with.
What this amendment does, it replaces the amendment that removed the aggravated assault in the 10-20 life. And the new amendment only removes acts of self-defense or self-defense of others from the 1020 life.
And Alachua County Public Defender Stacey Scott says while the amendment is not everything she'd hoped for, the Florida Public Defenders Association believes it's a start to help alleviate some unintended consequences.
It allows a judge to use discretion in sentencing in cases where it's a close case of self-defense, but maybe not a perfect case of self-defense. Nothing in this amendment would prevent a judge from giving the maximum or more, but it would allow a judge to get out from underneath the mandatory punishments that can be so severe and unjust in cases like the case of Marissa Alexander.
But Altamont Springs Republican Senator David Simmons questioned the language in the new change that states a person must have what's called a good faith belief that such conduct is necessary to defend themselves. Simmons wonders whether that definition should be expanded to help the defense, and public defender Scott says that might be a good idea.
I believe that using the term good faith is a step down from the normal criteria or standard in self-defense cases, which would be a reasonable belief. So the use of the term good faith is intentional, and I do believe that as written, it could encompass good faith but mistaken, but that language was not inserted in there. And I don't believe it's necessary, but it might be helpful.
Both Evers and Thrasher promised to look into that change before it heads for a 4-4 vote, and the measure passed the Senate Rules Committee with bipartisan support. Still, the bill received its first no vote in the Senate from Democratic leader Chris Smith.
Well, I think now is the wrong time to send a message to Floridians that you should, you know, shoot a warning shot. I understand that taking away the 10/20 life for people that, you know, do a warning for themselves and instead of killing someone. But I think in this climate right now, I'm uncomfortable doing something that can be perceived as a, hey, we can shoot a warning shot. The perception scares me with this current climate in the state of Florida.
He says instead the measure should give judges discretion over the law as a whole. The bill is expected to be taken up on the Senate for Thursday. Its House companion is already headed for the floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Meanwhile, a bipartisan bill seeking to tweak Stand Your Ground was heard late this afternoon. Sasha Cordner will have more on that story tomorrow. This week, the Miami Herald is reporting on a history of failures at Florida's Department of Children and Families, but these are failures with a body count. Over 6 years, at least 475 children died after DCF had been warned, sometimes repeatedly, that the kids or their siblings could be in danger. And as we hear from WLRN Miami Herald reporter Rick Stone, there were many missed opportunities where the state might have better protected the children in its care.
Ashton Arnold died of an accidental drug overdose while in the care of her addicted mother. The grandmother, Stacy Molinelli, blames DCF.
Had they done what they were supposed to do, this wouldn't have happened.
Little Tori Diamond of Davie was beaten to death by his mother's boyfriend. And another grandmother, Loretta Young, blames DCF.
They're responsible. They could have prevented my grandson's death.
Joseph Gilkerson's drug-addled fiancé, who had custody of their daughter, took up with a fellow drug user. They had an 8-foot pet python. The python escaped one night and killed the 2-year-old girl, Shauna Hare, in her crib. Gilkerson blames DCF.
They knew that the snake was there. They could have stepped in and protected her a little bit better.
In a series of reports that begin this week, the Miami Herald documents the deaths of more than 475 children over a 6-year period. They were beaten, starved, run over by cars, mauled by dogs, strangled by snakes, and smothered as they slept with drunk or drugged parents. In every single case, DCF had been warned, sometimes repeatedly, about safety issues in the homes. But following a policy of family preservation laid down in laws and agency rules, DCF elected to leave them in the homes where they would ultimately die.
You look at these death reviews, it's appalling. They're no-brainers.
Miami Circuit Judge Jerry Cohen hears a lot of child welfare cases. She thinks the quality of DCF personnel is a fundamental problem.
We are sending people into these complex environments that don't have the training, the skills, or the knowledge, or the supervision, really, to make the decisions that they need to make. They are completely over their head.
Pending bills in the legislature would require higher skills and better training for DCF caseworkers, and Governor Rick Scott says he's proposing to hire 400 additional investigators. But another basic problem remains. DCF has much more responsibility than authority. It can ask problem parents to take drug tests or sign agreements to improve their behavior, but Acting DCF Secretary Esther Jacobo says it can only ask.
Unless you take it to court, everything the parent does is voluntary. We have no ability to make anyone do anything unless a court orders them to do it.
And Judge Cohen says all of those parenting agreements and drug test orders would totally swamp the court system. But Stacey Mullinelli says the alternative to that, in the case of her own family, was death for her granddaughter Ashton, who had been living in the care of her addicted mother, Elizabeth Ridbaum.
Had they done their jobs following through, making sure that Elizabeth had taken the drug classes, making sure that she had taken the parenting classes, that Ashton would have been taken out of her care and put back with us, and she would have been safe.
Jacobo, the DCF chief, says her hands are tied to some extent by state and federal laws that make family preservation a priority. She says DCF should get better at making the decisions about whether an endangered kid is removed from a problematic home or not. But she says Florida is not alone with its preference for keeping families together.
All child welfare systems have that as their tenet, and the reasons behind that are several. One is the trauma of removal many times is more traumatic than the abuse.
In any case, says Jacobo, judges decide, not DCF, whether to take children into state care or leave them with their parents at home. These stories in a series called Innocence Lost continue this week in the Miami Herald. I'm Rick Stone.
Still to come on Capitol Report, when does life begin and when should government get involved in that life? The battle between those supporting fetal personhood and those who don't ramps up at the Florida Capitol.
In Florida, people believe that politicians should not be interfering in personal medical decisions, and that should be left between a woman, her faith, with the counsel of her doctor.
We'll find out what company will have Florida's business when it comes to testing public school students.
The negotiation team unanimously recommended nonprofit American Institutes for Research to me, and today I'm very happy to announce my selection of AIR.
We know millions of people already come to Florida for outstanding beaches and theme parks. How many more might come for the state's hospitals and other medical facilities? And Florida lawmakers will be showing their respect for a fallen governor tomorrow by suspending their usual duties for several hours.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment.
Abortion activists on both sides of the issue held dueling events at the Florida Capitol building today. Ryan Bank was there as well.
Ruth Rodriguez drags the aluminum legs of a large white tent across the floor in front of the Florida Capitol building's Waller Park entrance Monday morning. The sun is beginning to rise and a light rain sprinkles her group's displays. Rodriguez is a board member of Personhood Florida, the Sunshine State's chapter of Personhood USA, which advocates against any and all forms of abortion.
We come up to the Capitol to just educate both the citizens that are visiting the Capitol as well as the legislature regarding why we believe that everyone has a right to life.
It's Rodriguez's second year of Capitol City advocacy. She says her Christian faith is her biggest motivator.
We are one of the few pro-life groups that states very clearly that we are made in the image of God. And because we are made in the image of God, we believe that those rights are given to us by our Creator.
She's certainly not alone in her opposition to abortion. In fact, recent national polls show opposition growing among most age groups. But the pro-life movement in Florida hasn't had the same success. A 2012 personhood referendum that would have effectively banned most abortions failed to garner the 60% of votes needed to pass. A number of bills in the 2013 legislative session died before even reaching the floor. The only abortion-related measure to pass last session required doctors to provide emergency care to a baby who survives an abortion attempt. This year, lawmakers are again considering changes to the state's abortion policies. Lakeland Republican Representative Kelly Stargell is sponsoring a bill that would treat an act of violence against a pregnant woman and her fetus as separate offenses. Miami Republican Representative Anatera Flores filed a bill requiring doctors to use ultrasounds to assess the viability of an unborn child. and Pensacola Republican Senator Greg Evers is again submitting his personhood bill that would ban nearly all types of abortions.
Is this a great crowd I have with me here today, or what?
Although a pro-life swing seems very real, that doesn't mean pro-choice advocates have gone silent. In addition to calling for legislators to expand Medicaid, Planned Parenthood activists huddled around the Capitol building's first floor rotunda Monday to reiterate support for a woman's right to choose. Heather Brying is a University of Central Florida student. She says she made the four-hour trip to let lawmakers know how big of an issue health care and reproductive rights are to young voters.
I realized the importance of getting young people involved in actively being able to advocate for their own health and reproductive rights, and also advocating that to the greater community of Orlando. So I got really impassioned around that and got involved.
Although it was clear that the more than 50 Planned Parenthood activists were pro-choice, leaders tried hard not to deviate from their press conference's message of expanding health care. Florida Planned Parenthood spokesperson Laura Goodhue says that's because the group is confident in Florida's pro-choice credentials.
In 2012, we actually had a ballot initiative that was anti-choice and would have restricted women's access to health care, and it was soundly defeated. So we know that in Florida, people believe that politicians should not be interfering in personal medical decisions, and that should be left between a woman, her faith, with the counsel of her doctor.
Thus far, the only abortion-related bill to receive a hearing this session is Representative Stargell's Offenses Against Unborn Children proposal. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
The American Institutes for Research has been named as the state's new testing vendor. Lynn Hatter reports the AIR company will build and design the exam, replacing Florida's outgoing Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test, or FCAT.
The FCAT was initially supposed to be replaced by Common Core-lined English and math exams developed by a coalition of states. Those tests were called PARC. But Florida officials began pulling back from both Common Core and its attached tests, leaving the state without an FCAT replacement. Monday, Florida got its answer from Education Commissioner Pam Stewart.
I have chosen the not-for-profit American Institutes for Research, or commonly referred to as AIR, to provide the new English Language Arts and Mathematics Assessment, which will be administered in the 2014 school year. That will be in the spring of 2015.
Last month, a review committee recommended AIR for the state testing contract, largely due to the company's ability to build a test that won't need to be field tested and can be administered on computers, as well as with paper and number two pencils. AIR is also working on the state of Utah's assessments. They're not the same tests Florida will use, but Stewart says she's okay with not having Florida students involved in benchmarking AIR's process.
Field testing informs the vendor with whether or not items are appropriate items, and so we feel very confident in the ability of their field testing to inform their items moving forward with us.
Utah was an early adopter of the other Common Core-aligned testing consortium called Smarter Balanced, but it pulled out of that consortium last year, much like Florida is doing now with PARC. AIR head of testing John Cohen says his company has been involved in building the Smarter Balanced testing platform.
We had a small part in the item development. We were a subcontractor to CTV McGraw-Hill, and we had a very large role in the test delivery. So our role there is to help to deliver the test online and to deliver to them actually an open source system so that others can deliver the test online.
And there are only a select few companies that build the kind of massive testing network states like Florida must have to administer statewide exams. Other applicants for the Florida contract included large firms such as Pearson and McGraw-Hill. In an exchange with a reporter, State Education Commissioner Pam Stewart noted that just because AIR has been involved with the Smarter Balanced Consortium doesn't mean that we'll follow the firm to Florida.
They've also were chosen to be the platform of delivery for the Smarter Balanced Assessment. So I guess my question is this the same platform that they're doing for Smarter Balanced, or is this going to be something totally unique and different from what they're already doing?
Please don't confuse the two, Gary.
That's why I asked the question.
That's right. This is a platform and assessment for Florida.
Officials with the Utah Department of Education say they are not using smarter balanced-based questions on their exams, and Florida DOE spokesman Joe Follick says the same will be true for Florida.
There will not be any questions used by any national consortiums on this Florida assessments when they are in Florida schools for the next school year. Very clear from the beginning that the emphasis on making the selection was on a test that was going to be designed for the unique needs of Florida students.
How Florida will be able to compare its students to those in other states is still unclear, though Stewart says the state will have that ability. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Talking with Florida Public Radio's Jessica Plumbo as we start yet another week of the 2014 Florida lawmaking session with a tourism story, Jessica. And usually we think of tourism in terms of major attractions, Disney, Universal, SeaWorld, all that sort of thing, and people coming to Florida for fun in the sun. But this is a different type of tourism, isn't it?
Florida has almost record numbers of that kind of tourism already, and one North Florida Senator Aaron Bean is hoping to attract medical tourists to Florida. He has a proposal he's told me earlier today. He's excited that it's getting its first hearing. Kind of this new idea is getting its first hearing in the legislature. Some background. Last year, the legislature appropriated more than $60 million to Visit Florida, which is the state's tourism promotion agency that works with local tourism boards, usually with matching funds to attract people to different areas of the state. And this year, Governor Rick Scott has actually asked the legislature for $100 million for that Visit Florida agency. And Senator Bean from Fernandina Beach says if we're already investing so heavily in tourism, what's a couple more million dollars to tell people what great hospitals we have here and what great medical practitioners we have in Florida. So he wants $5 million to go specifically to medical tourism promotion, using that same matching system with the local boards. This would be voluntary participation. Senator Bean mentioned places like Fernandina Beach, his home district, Miami is already promoting this in some ways. Jacksonville, he's hoping places like Pensacola in the Panhandle will jump on board and say, hey, you know, instead of promoting their beaches and their resorts, hey, look at the great hospitals and doctors we have here.
Okay, so it would be sort of like what? Got cancer? Come to the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa and get a half-price coupon for admission to the Tampa Aquarium? Or how would that work?
I guess that would be up to the local tourism development councils to decide exactly what's going to work for each of them. I talked with one of the Chamber of Commerce members in Fernandina Beach today, and he said with Jacksonville being so close and you have University of Florida's proton therapy and Mayo Clinic, places like that there, that they might be able to promote Fernandina Beach as the resort that you go and recover in after you've had your surgery or your procedure in Jacksonville, for example.
What is old is new again, because Florida used to be a place where people would come to recover from all sorts of illnesses. There were springs for therapy and all that. So it's kind of like we're going back to where we were maybe 150 years ago.
Sure. And Senator Bean says if this works, we're going to have fewer empty hospital beds in Florida. And hopefully that will translate to the stimulation of local economies.
We'll see if that gets traction in the legislature as we go forward. Florida Public Radio's Jessica Palumbo. Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks, Tom.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Now here's Ronald J. Eben with a preview of Tuesday's happenings at the Florida Capitol.
The Senate Children, Families, and Elder Affairs Committee and the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee will take up proposals that would help curb human trafficking and sexual exploitation. The Senate Committee meets at 8 Tuesday morning, the House Subcommittee at 3 Tuesday afternoon. The Senate Education Committee meets at 8 a.m., to take up a bill filed by Senator Jack Latvala that would make a series of changes in higher education tuition, including allowing undocumented immigrant students to qualify for in-state tuition rates. The Senate Judiciary Committee will consider a bill filed by Senator John Thrasher that would place some restrictions on lawsuits against nursing homes. Among other things, the bill would shield passive investors from liability when nursing homes are sued because of resident injuries or deaths. That meeting at 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning. The Senate goes into session at 10:30 Tuesday morning and could approve measures such as a bill filed by Majority Leader Elizabeth Benequisto, Fort Myers Republican, that would ban the sale of electronic cigarettes to minors. The House Choice and Innovation Subcommittee meets at 12:30 to consider a proposal that would lead to a major expansion of the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship Program, which helps pay for low-income children to attend private schools. That's part of the legislative agenda for Tuesday, March 18th. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally, this evening, we just heard Ronald J. Eben relay tomorrow's Capitol action. However, there will also be a period of solemn inaction as well. A series of events paying tribute to the late Governor Reuben Askew begins in Tallahassee tomorrow. Stan Jastrzebski has more on how lawmakers will honor a man many acknowledge changed the face of Florida politics.
It's fitting the late governor's body will lie in state at the historic Florida Capitol starting at 10 Tuesday morning. Askew was the state's chief executive when the state inaugurated its current Capitol complex and presided over that ceremony. Senate President Don Gates, who counted Askew as a personal friend, says he and other leaders were moved to change the legislative calendar to accommodate Tuesday's remembrance.
The Florida legislature has decided to pause in our regular business to allow the leaders of our state to be present when Governor Askew's body comes to the old Capitol tomorrow, lay in state.
Legislative business will also be suspended around noon Tuesday to give lawmakers another chance to walk across the courtyard to the historic Capitol. Gates says he will take additional time at the end of the week to offer one final gesture to his late friend.
And then on Friday, I plan to leave Tallahassee and accompany Governor Askew's body to Pensacola, where he will be laid to rest.
But there's one question surrounding Tuesday's paying of respects. Is Askew's coffin lying in state? You see, to lie in state, a body usually must reside in the primary building a government uses. But since the historic Capitol has been replaced by a newer version and is now a museum, Askew's body might technically be said to lie in repose. It's an interesting language lesson to be considered as lawmakers and the public alike pay their last respects, which may be just as the governor-turned-college professor would have wanted it. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo, along with Ryan Bank. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2014 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through Delta Airlines and Delta Connection partner ExpressJet, with direct flights from Tallahassee to Atlanta connecting to over 315 destinations worldwide. Fares and information available online at delta.com. And from HR Florida State Council, representing 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for workplace best practices for the media, lawmakers, and Florida's human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.